There you go. Aside from that, tonight David McDonough will be talking to us on the life or and or work of Norman Angell. He will start right about now, I shouldn't. David.
Oh, right. Well, I'm going to introduce a prelude on which a talk is not worthy giving on. The name of the talk was Norman Angell and the Problem of War. But my short prelude will be, I suppose, David McDonough and the Problem of War. This is just a prelude to what appeared in the write-up. Around about 1965, when I was 17, I came across a Trotskyite who was well into the theory of communism. I might just mention the distinction between communism and socialism here that Lenin made and that Trotskyites accepted. Socialism was more or less nationalisation or state running of the economy, according to Lenin, and communism was where you had a moneyless society where everything was near enough perfect, although it was party line to deny that this was really the case, and it was more realistic than something that was perfect. But nevertheless, the Trotskyites pushed forward the idea that we could have a world of automated abundance where no one had to work. And I put forward the line with my friend Martin that this would destroy the human beings, because the Lamarckian type idea that I had, because basically work kept us fit in some sort of way or other. So it was a Lamarckian line that I didn't know anything about Darwin at that time, and indeed I didn't discover the difference between neo-Darwinism and Lamarckianism until some 4 or 5 years later, when I started reading neo-Darwinism. In fact, I read Julian Huxley, The Modern Synthesis, which was a book published in 1948, which explained, of course, the genetics and stuff. I wasn't attracted by the idea of communism because of where you wouldn't have to work, because even though it would solve certain problems like mass unemployment and war, because I thought that it would render people they'd decline and they'd become less and less fit in their ever way. There's a Lamarckian type thing. However, I forgot that objection to communism when a few years later I watched a film of All Quiet on the Western Front, which was produced in 1933 of a book published around about 1919 or thereabouts by Lamarck, and I later Remarque, and I later got that book All Quiet on the Western Front and read it out. But the film, it was the film that mainly had the basic impact on me. It reduced me to tears and convinced me that the tremendous problem of war that was totally and utterly superfluous and was something that should not exist. And I came across the Socialist Party of Great Britain and our common friend David Steele was a member of Birmingham branch, and I joined them on the idea that this would solve the problem of war. Oddly enough, though, I didn't look into the Marxist answer to the problem of war very very clearly. I suppose really because I guess most propagandists who adopt the creed, I mean, there's a number of curious things about adopting the creed. One is that you do adopt it by assumption and find out what the creed says later on. That is always the case. The growing Christian finds out what the Christian thinks through later study. The growing Muslim does the same, and the growing almost any religion is almost bound to do the same, and the same for the Marxist or even the liberal. Secondly, and this is perhaps even more problematic, people who are committed to ideas have a look at this is brought out very well in The Life of Brian. They have a look at what their rivals within the given ideology are saying, and they basically think of what the rivals in the given ideology are saying. So in The Life of Brian they say, who are the main enemy? Oh, it's the Judeo-Christian Judeo-Libertarian Front and says, well, and well, no, I mean the real main enemy, I was the Liberation Front for Judaism and so on. He says, no, no, what about the Romans? I almost forgot about the Romans. It's the same in the House of Commons. You know, what the enemies, he says, no, the enemies aren't the opposition, it's the people behind you in where you find your enemies. So basically what you have is a situation where the ideologue or the committee person is worrying about things on the edge of their theory, which takes up all the basic any basic absurdity that happens to be in the theory is taken for granted, and they talk about sensible things on the periphery, certain problems. It's like John Henry Newman in Roman Catholicism, a very intelligent man, John Henry Newman. But a lot of his debates and thoughts were about with fellow Christians who took the basic assumptions for granted, and he worked at quite sensible quite intellectual problems on the periphery, where you weren't looking at the basic absurdities at all. You were just looking at problems which are totally not really coherent. So I didn't look at the exactly how capitalism crowded out war or got rid of it. Sorry, communism. It's a bit of a mistake there. I looked at problems of socialism on the periphery. In the course of this, I started studying from A levels, and I studied social and economic history, and here I came across a version of Cobden and Bright's solution to the problem of war. I was a bit surprised to find that the Anti-Corn Law League was to do with the problem of war, and but I read their solution, Free Trade Crowds Out War, and the idea that there was no, if it wasn't for taxation, you wouldn't have a means of financing the armaments industry and that sort of thing, which was part of the Cobden and Bright. And I looked at the criticisms of it put forward by Peter Matthias and other the First Industrial Nation and other books on the social and economic history, and they all seemed to be pretty lame and weak. And so I started looking at I went into the Birmingham Reference Library and I started looking at Cobden's political writings, which was published a year after his death in 1865, there are two volumes, and I found that these writings were very, first of all, I found they were very well written, and they struck me as being first-rate writings, and they put forward his ideas very eloquently, and I come to think that the criticism of him was superficial, and that he was probably right. And later on, when David Steele introduced me to the economic calculation argument, which I found it took me a couple of days to get to comprehend the economic calculation argument. I said anyway, that if I was in his position, which I didn't think I would be joining him in his position, I wouldn't call myself a libertarian, but a liberal. A shorter word and more likely to be successful. But I also referred him to Cobden and Bright on the problem of war, and said that there probably was a advanced solution for the problem of war anyway. After a bit, I get more and more fond of Cobden and Bright and the problem of war. Now, very short history of the liberal idea of the, which is the idea that Angel takes up. But there is a bit of a twist towards this, The history is basically, it starts off basically, I guess, with Erasmus, who loses some of his students at the Battle of Flodgen, he then says that war is a very wicked thing and that no one can gain from it. This is developed by a number of writers, basically developed in detail by the some of the French ministers. The physiocrats, now called the physiocrats, they call themselves the economists in France, and these influenced Adam Smith, who introduced the idea into in his book The Wealth of Nations, which has still got many great seminal ideas. For example, he's got ideas against slavery as well as against war, So Adam Smith basically put forward the case that without taxation you'd have no means to maintain the army, and you'd have no means to maintain proper defence. But also Adam Smith put forward the idea that as you develop the worldwide division of labour, nations become dependent upon interdependent, and this meant that war would disrupt the economic life of the attacking country as well as the country that was being attacked, and all this was a grand disincentive to war. So the twofold thing, you know, war disrupts the home country, and in more or less hitting the enemy you're also hitting yourself to some degree, and also the funds to pay for the war didn't come naturally within the market, but it had to come from taxation. Now, Cobden and Bright used Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations a bit like the Christians used the Bible, and of course they held meetings up and down the country. In most they spoke in Birmingham, Edinburgh, and so on, up and down the country, and they carried with them the Wealth of Nations, more or less reading out of it, and you're carrying it with them as the Christian groups carry the Bible around with them and quoting out of it, and they pushed forward their main idea of the Anti-Corn Law League was if we got rid of the Corn Laws and introduced a greater amount of free trade, there'd be greater interdependence and there'd be a grand solution to war. Now they went in for a form of isolationism. They saw the state as when the state interfered with other countries, when you had international politics, they saw it as a form of not really minding its own business, but minding the business of other states. Cobden was upset by how much the House of Commons was discussing the world events instead of discussing the events of its own domains, and he especially had a look at how negligent the British were of Ireland, which is supposed to be united in the Act of Union since 1800, and whilst it was talking about all sorts of places, South America and Russia and Turkey and everywhere apart from its own domain, he thought that this was silly and they should mind their own business. Deal with their own domain and sort out the problems in Ireland and the north of England and elsewhere first, and then see if they could help other people after they'd help their own problems. But he never did go so far as to see, as some LAers have done, some people in the Libertarian Alliance have done, as see politics itself as problematic. I suppose I'm one of those LAers who do see the problematic politics itself, as I've often said in our list, as being negative, some or internecine, and or being antisocial, and almost any political activity is going to be dysfunctional and wasteful, and almost any trade is going to be functional and beneficial to mutually beneficial. In other words, trade is a positive sum game, but politics is a negative sum game. So the laws of trade are diametrically the opposite of the laws of war. You know, Cobden didn't go that far. In fact, he thought he had a certain naivety as regards to politics, and he actually thought that the state would be very good in education, and that state schools would be a boon. And he thought the state was all right if it just minded its own business and kept to itself. But basically, he was against all diplomacy. He wouldn't have had any embassies in other countries, because he thought that any international politics was a form of warmongering. And I think that this is right here, you know, if you take the those other ideas that I've just mentioned, that the state is actually the use of proactive coercion, and therefore it is coercing someone else, and when you're coercing someone, it's a form of cold war, and the cold war is pushing onto hot war, or if I start pushing you around in a coercive manner, you might likely hit me and give me a smack in the chops, which means it stops being cold war and it becomes actual war. So, you know, and this is the case: if you start pushing people around politically, you may get a political response, and this could be sanctions to begin with, which Cobden always hated. In fact, Cobden always thought that sanctions was worse than war itself, because he thought it often made infant mortality rise, and that the very innocent in society are getting hurt by sanctions. And he didn't like the idea that people thought there was nothing wrong with sanctions, because he thought that this is just becoming a state of hubris and overlooking the problems that sanctions was doing, whereas in war they, at least they could see, or a few of them were so blind that they couldn't see the damage they were doing in war. So Cobden absolutely hated sanctions, so Cobden had Cobden's solution to this, which was the liberal solution to this, was isolationism, no diplomacy at all, no contact between politicians and different countries at all, but free trade, plenty of contact between people on the economic level. Tariff barriers, bring down all the tariff barriers, allowed complete free trade, but limit politics. It was a limitation of politics. Now, I think if we could limit politics in that way, politics probably wouldn't be so bad, if it didn't do very much, then it wouldn't do very much harm, but if it does a lot, then it can do a lot of harm. When Angell took up the problem of war, he wrote, Cobden once said that, in fact it's quoted in one of Angell's books, that if he had some leisure, he could really do justice to the problem of war, more so than what he had done in his scattered writings, when he mentions it here and there. And Angell did do this. Angell did write a whole book on the problem of war, and he developed it in more detail than Cobden, but again it's along the same lines. The International Division of Labour brings the whole world to being interdependent, and there was no natural movement within trade towards war. Any movement towards that came entirely from politics, and it was and Angell thought it was levelled on by what he called the Great Illusion, which was the idea that war paid, and he thought that if people realised that war didn't pay, then they probably wouldn't back up the idea of war. Now, Angell did, though, like Cobden, he never saw the state as being dysfunctional or the state as being antisocial in any way. On the contrary, both Cobden and Angell thought the state was all right within its own domain. And Angell, in his pamphlet of 126 pages called Europe's Optical Illusion, published in 1908, in that pamphlet he just put forward the Cobdenite idea, but as it expanded into the Great Illusion in 1909 and then in 1910, he started thinking in terms of some sort of a political alliance to more or less bring about a state of affairs where war was deterred. But this was on the margin of his thinking, but this margin started growing and growing throughout the rest of his life. And when war broke out in 1914, of course, many people, both with Cobden and with Angell, many people thought that Cobden had said that war was impossible owing to free trade, and they thought that they had complete free trade under Cobden, and they thought that Cobden ought to have been surprised by the Crimean War, but of course Cobden wasn't at all surprised by the Crimean War, and he didn't hold that war was rendered impossible. He just held that war didn't pay. And of course we didn't have complete free trade in Cobden's setup, because we still had the state, and complete free trade would mean no state at all. If you've got a state, then that state must, just by existing, must limit free trade to some extent, so you just have a measure of free trade while we've got the state there. But of course Cobden did not, Cobden was no anarchist any more than Angell was, Angell, when the war happened, of course. Again, it was no surprise to him. He knew that it was going to come. But nevertheless, in the wake of this war, he started thinking more and more along this marginal idea of other powers deterring war. And he was to develop that more and more and more as time went on. That more or less completes my prelude. In fact, I've gone into a bit into the life of Angel. In a sense, Angel is a writer that, like Tom Paine, relates to the classical liberal case. In the beginning of his writings, like in Tom Paine's Rights of Man Part 1, it's almost it's almost completely classical liberal. In Tom Paine Part 2, it goes to be what I would call neoliberal. Of course, the people would reverse those terms today, and they'd say that libertarianism was neoliberal, and that in other words, the Rights of Man Part 2 tends to advocate the welfare state. Well, likewise, from about 1914 onwards, Angel went further and further into, first of all, he was into the idea of the League of Nations, and then after the Second World War, the United Nations. He was disappointed with the United Nations, though. He didn't like the fact that every single petty state had a single vote in the United Nations, and he thought it was dominated by too many small states. And the big states were tending to ignore this and stuff. So on. He was a bit dissatisfied with how it functioned, but he's going more and more towards that sort of solution to the problem of the war. And as Stephen Berry said to me yesterday when we were talking about this, this idea of the United Nations is of fighting. Wars, nipping war in the bud, as it were, of threatening powers that are going to invade other countries, such as Italy tried to invade, or actually did invade, Ethiopia. Threatening them at that time is a recipe for war. You're almost bound to have to fight these wars, because these are the developing nations like Italy and Germany are going to say, well, why should developed nations like Britain have all the colonies, and why shouldn't we have the colonies? They're going to see it as unjust, and they're probably going to fight, in which case you're going to get the war which you're fighting to avoid. You've got this paradox, a paradox which the Marxists rejected, of fighting for peace, because in fighting you're ensuring that you don't get peace. Angel in 1910 and before the 1914 did embrace a position far more like my own today, but what he found unsatisfactory with neutrality is that he thought that a hawk state could pick off states one by one unless there was an alliance, and he thought that a League of Nations or a United Nations might deter the warmongers, as it were, and solve the problem that way. Well, I think that it's true that that you have got the problem with the hawk state. You have got the problem of war. The problem of war is an objective problem, but it's a problem posed by the nation state, and it's a problem posed by high taxation. It needs high taxation, or reasonably high taxation, to fund it. Now, if the liberal solution, liberalism generally, was widely spread, people would demand low taxation, and this would make it hard for war to get underway. People would put, and also, of course, they would see through these, they'd see the high cost of war and so on. But there is something else that Angel overlooked in this as well. It was that Angel did think this was largely a problem of mass psychology. It is a shocking fact that in 1914 the vast majority of people celebrated at the outbreak of World War I. They celebrated in the streets. Bertrand Russell writes about this, And George Orwell writes about it in Coming Up for Air. And it's a bit like, I mean, there's two shocking facts related to First World War. One, the fact that I've just mentioned, that people welcomed the war, and of course they thought it'd be all over by Christmas and so on. Secondly, in the wake of World War One in 1918, there was a tremendous plague which almost destroyed as many lives worldwide as the war did itself. But I just mentioned that second fact just in passing. Obviously it's not to the point, but the one that is to the point is the first fact that people did actually welcome World War One, and they celebrated it, and they thought it would be all over shortly and so on, and they were willing to however, this shocking fact obfuscates what I think is a fact that Angel overlooked, and that he shouldn't have overlooked, and that even Cobden overlooked to some slighter extent, and that is the fact that the roots of war are not in human nature, they are in the institution of the state, they are in institutions. Many people have said that we cannot reinvent the nuclear bomb, but it doesn't, of course it doesn't matter whether we can uninvent the nuclear bomb. Beg your pardon. It doesn't matter that we cannot uninvent the nuclear bomb if there is no institutional incentive to use the nuclear bomb. The problem of war and the problem of nuclear war is the fact that there is an institutional incentive to war, and that institutional incentive is the state. And so I think the actual liberal solution to the problem of war is to either severely limit the state, or even one for the distant future perhaps is to get rid of the state altogether in liberal anarchy. But either way, you strike at the real cause of the problem of war, which is institutional. It's sociological, if you like, rather than psychological. But Angel was most certainly taken with the very real fact that there is a lot of psychological support for the problem of war, and that people like war. Immanuel Kant thought that democracy would get rid of war because the vast majority of people wouldn't support war as it was against their interests given a democracy. And there was became quite a celebrated idea just recently in the 1990s. There was a book called Never at War, which actually put forward this idea just a few years ago, and about 2001, somewhere around about there. Of course, this overlooks the fact that even recent wars, I mean the Falklands War, for example, was celebrated by quite a few people, notwithstanding the fact that it was celebrated by quite a few people in Birmingham, notwithstanding the fact that we now got as far as I can see, I mean it was celebrated in Birmingham, notwithstanding the fact that we've got a large since the First World War, we have a large tradition which is more or less an anti-war tradition, and the way our people went into the Second World War was certainly not in the way they went into the First World War. It was considered a duty and a right war, but it was fought with somewhat regret rather than with gusto as the First World War was fought. And of course the tradition, the anti-war tradition, dates from the aftermath, from the surprise of the First World War, of how brutal war can be. And as I say, even myself in the 1960s was influenced against the idea of war, not by the Second World War, but by the First World War, by books related to the First World War, All Quiet on the Western Front. And so even now the anti-war position dates from the First World War. But notwithstanding that tradition, it was celebrated by some people. Bob didn't see them very much in London. They might not have been so much celebrated in Stevenage and London, but in Birmingham it was celebrated by certain people. So war is generally popular even now, so there is this psychological element. But as I say, the psychological element isn't as strong as the institutional element. Now there are one or two stories about Cobden's life that I'd like to get in, one or two paradoxes I suppose, but one is that this pamphlet 1908, European Optical Illusion
in Angel's Eye
was a complete flop, and it hardly sold at all, and it was going to be remainder. But Angel had this bright idea of buying up all the remainder copies and sending them to eminent people, and he sent about 400 of these off to various people. And lo and behold, some of these people were journalists and so on, and they reviewed it. And so he got reviewed for the first time, notwithstanding the fact that it was a complete flop. And so he quickly revised it up into a book, the more than 126 pages, The Great Illusion, which is the big book, his most important book. And one of these was a Lord Escher, who really adopted Angel more or less. Really lovely. Now, this Lord Escher was in charge of the problem of the war for the king. The king was King Edward the Seventh, was very much worried about the war spirit in Europe, and he got this Lord Escher to have a look to see if you can find common ground between the big parties, Liberal Party and the Tory Party as they then were, to see if something could be done to dent this war spirit and prevent war. Escher got his friend Sir Thomas Garton to set up a Garton Foundation to promote Angel. Now, Angel got his revised book about 270 pages into print in 1910, and again he revised it, expanding again in 1911 and again in 1912. And Escher got the former Prime Minister Balfour to say that this was not an ordinary radical book, but a book worth taking seriously. And the whole idea is Escher wanted people, not only in Britain, on both sides of the House in Britain and all sides in Britain, to read it, but he also wanted people in Germany to read it. And Angel went and lectured all on Germany, to try to lecture them. Of course, he found a lot of Germans there saying, you know, silly English shopkeepers would be against war, and they don't understand. And here, they told Angel an idea that should have taken more note of. He said, they don't understand, you see the petty cash, he says, you don't understand honour, you English shopkeepers. And this is a big thing, because you see, Angel never did fully comprehend that as soon as you've got an institution like the state that actually goes on your honour and you get a clash, you know, it is your honour, you don't care about money, it's your honour, you're willing to spend any amount of money on that sort of silly thing. So really speaking, he wasn't really on the ball with the economic costs of war. He should have been, Angel said in his first book, which was published in 1903, called Patriotism Under Free Flags, he had been worried when he went to America, which he did, actually I've got this a bit out of, but he'd been worried when he went to America, which he did at the age of 17 for about 7 years, and then it was followed by a period of 16 years in Paris in France. And he was also worried about America by the warmongering outlook in America. As soon as they had a slight clash between Britain and Venezuela, the Americans said, although it was nothing to do with them, let's go and back up Venezuela against Britain and let's go to war. And he was worried about the psychology of this, how they took so readily to war, even when it was none of their business, as it were. And when he went to France, he was worried about the big fuss about the Dreyfus case, although he was pro-Dreyfus, and he wrote many articles pro-Dreyfus. Nevertheless, he didn't like the fact that there were so many people against Dreyfus, and he worried about that problem. And Britain, he's worried about the undue support, as he saw it, for the Boer War, which he thought was again, you know, not really affecting the lives of people in Britain. Why are they so enthusiastic about it? So he really was hooked on the psychology business of war, and he wrote this book in 1903 called Patriotism Under Free Flags, basically on what he considered to be the irrationality of public opinion, idea that he kept on in many books throughout his life, including books written in as late as the 1960s. He died in 1967, by the way, and he was born in 1872. So he had this, you know, but throughout this, he just looked at the economics of it. He didn't look at the fact, you know, in fact, he had this pet idea that was in the 1903 book, namely that it isn't the facts that determine matters, but the way how people see the facts. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's perfectly correct. But the point is, very often, it isn't the facts at all that matters, but values. In other words, what people consider to be important. Now, I think that's quite a big distinction. We know that it's not complete, because any value situation is going to need some factual basis. You know, if I've got a high value and you tell me there's, and you convince me there's nothing, there's no chance of it whatsoever, i.e. you convince me that it's futile, then my values will quickly evaporate as soon as I realise the futility of it. In other words, in order to maintain a value, you need some sort of factual basis. However, there is all the difference in the world between just having a look at certain facts and having a look at certain values, and here's the difference that the German students pointed out to Angel in his tours of Germany. Namely, it's not about economics, it's about honour. And that's a bit, you know, that's a, there is a difference there between that, which is captured in the fact value distinction. So throughout his life, he put on this, this pamphlet was going to be a failure, but he sent these 400 copies to these various people, and he got a, and the actual reverse happened. When he got this 1910 out, he got one out in 1909, but then he got a second one out in 1910. The 1910 edition, it was translated into other languages, sold over 1 million copies. I think that's something, isn't it? We're going back into 1910. You know, not just in Britain, but you know, in America as well, it sold, and the translations in Germany and France and elsewhere. And not only that, but an extra thing happened, because Escher, as I said, was organising his Garton Foundation, and Sir Thomas Garton set up the Garton Foundation, which gave him a platform, as it were. But what emerged in the years before 1914 was something similar emerged in our own time in the 1950s. I don't know whether you can remember Colin Wilson and Colin Wilson societies, i.e. you had the outsider, and there was a kind of like a fan club following the outsider all over. Well, the same thing happened to the Great Illusion in Britain before 1914. There was Norman Angelism, and this really became a big movement, not only in Britain, but even in Germany and France and so on. There were Norman Angel societies, and not only that, a whole journal was set up, a journal called War and Peace, which was a Norman Angelism monthly, and it had all sorts of writers writing for it, including people who we've heard of. There is the celebrated economist, J.A. Hobson.
Oh, yes.
Have you heard of J. Lowes Dickinson?
Yes.
There are a number of other writers, Barrettsford and other writers wrote for it. But it was a Norman Angel monthly, and the whole thing was a mass psychology thing. Oh, right. So I haven't even mentioned that little fact yet. So I ought to mention that little fact. It's at the beginning of the story, so I should have mentioned it, but I'll mention it and get it over with in the next few minutes. Angel, while he was in America, this is a little fact, actually married. And I think that shocked Bob, because it shocked me and Bob. We had a look at the fact that Angel never had anything to do with women at all. But of course, he didn't ask for this particular marriage. It was a big surprise. And the only thing he was willing to say was this: if I'd looked into her past character, I'd have realised what she was like. But I didn't. I only found that out after my wedding. And he's so much abhorred her that he wouldn't even bother to have contact with her to get a divorce. So, as far as he was concerned, when he was writing about her in the 1950s, she was still alive, as far as he knew, and he didn't want anything to do with her. And that's talking about something that happened in 1895. So we're talking about almost 60 years earlier. And you know, he had nothing whatsoever to do with women in romance. He had a lot of female friends, but no romance after that. After that, that was his first and last romance. Once bitten, you know, many times shy in danger. That's a little fact. But anyhow, so he come near the beginning, I think it's probably surprised Bob and maybe Stephen, I don't know. But that's what I've been looking. It surprised me when I found it out just a few days ago. That's a little fact. So in the interwar years, I'll just polish it off. He was he went into he's running around where he should go in, and what he should do throughout the war. He was going to join the Labour Party in 1916, but he decided not to. In 1920, he did join the Labour Party. He stood for three elections. Eventually, he got elected as MP for Bradford North. He was then he was a crony of MacDonald, but he didn't like MacDonald, just like he was a crony of also Harmsworth, that is Northcliffe. But he didn't particularly like what he was doing in public, but he liked them personally, both of them. And he was knighted to Norman Angel, and he was offered a seat in the House of Lords, which he refused. Now, I think he should have taken it, because it's obviously a propagandist who's got a message, needs a platform, and the House of Lords is the perfect platform. But he refused it after he, because he was unseated in the 1931 election, and he was offered a seat in the House of Lords, and he refused it. And he was knighted. Oh, that's right. In 1933, he got the Nobel Prize for Peace. Mm. That's another thing. It was announced only in 1934, and he gave his Nobel Prize address, "War and the Public Mind." You know, talking about the the mass psychology of war rather than the sociology of war. And after the he also joined a group called the Focus, which was totally and utterly, earlier on he criticised Winston Churchill a great deal, but the Focus was a group devoted to putting Churchill back into power, so he'd become a complete Churchillite. And the 1947 book is a sort of Churchillite position on the Cold War in 1947, affecting the Soviet Union and the threat of the Soviet Union and so on. So he's quite a prominent fellow in socially, and you know, having the knighthood and place in the House of Lords and Nobel Prize. In fact, you know, he's quite a success all in all, although we've largely forgotten him today, I suppose. So after the Second World War, he devoted himself to the United Nations. I said earlier on he was a bit disappointed with the results, but he wanted to deter war by facing the paradox of fighting for peace head on, with the apology, a bit similar to an apology that some people give for capital punishment, namely that if it does deter war, then it won't have to be used and we won't have to fight for peace. But of course, as Stephen said yesterday in a conversation to me, sadly it is a recipe for war. So with that, I open
the
discussion.
Yes, quote Cobden, there should be more intercourse between peoples and less between governments.
Yes, indeed.
Make love, not war.
Yes.
Right, first question. Anyway, comment, observation?
I just want to give my opinion on the Falklands War.
Oh, yes.
Britain owned the Falklands much before Argentina became a republic.
That's true.
And it was the principle of the matter more than anything else. And it was a very, very good thing to do. Now, this nonsense with Blair going into Iraq and on the false pretense, Bertrand Russell would have tried to Blair and Bush for war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
That is a useless war. And the Second World War was a necessary war as well, because Germany went too far. Read Little Hart's book.
Have
you read it?
I have, but I need to reread it. I'm a bit rusty on it.
I'll touch on the Falklands thing while we're warming up all this. I have to say, I was there, we were there at the time, weren't we?
Yeah.
I noticed no jingoism. There were people putting a bold front on saying goodbye to their loved ones. Well, why wouldn't you? And waving the flag and wishing them all the best. That certainly was the case, but as far as I got a feeling, it can't be entirely right, it was more that I suppose we have to, it's the proper thing to do, we'd rather not, but it's probably going to take this to shift them, at least to take us seriously and maybe negotiate, or at least we may have to fight eventually. And that seemed to me the feeling at the time. After the victory, well, by that time Anglican bishops and the Guardian and the rest of them were already saying we mustn't. I mean, I mustn't be triumphalist about this. It's fair enough.
I remember at the time that the Balkans War was breaking out, one of my friends was very worried because she thought that they might drop nuclear bombs on us. And I had to point out that we had them, but that they didn't.
Ah, well, that is true.
Yes, that's correct. Quite right, Paul. We did have them and they didn't. But me and Steve wrote a piece at the time, more or less saying that the Falklands War was probably the right thing to do, so we did say that. But
you said it would have been financed by public subscription, so popular was it? That's what you said.
Is that what we said? I've forgotten.
Said, yeah.
No, I don't
think we've forgotten. I have to reread what we said.
I haven't.
I wouldn't dip into my pocket to that extent. No.
I'll have to reread what we said.
I know what you said.
Oh, yes, you know better than I do.
It's a bit by the by, but while we're here, it seems to me that if the Argentinians are simply politely, firmly, without violence, remove all the islanders, put them on an aircraft and got them flown back to Europe, and then said, look, it's only a bunch of rocks. We're willing to discuss a settlement, and all the inhabitants are invited back if they want to, or receive compensation. It would have been very difficult to fight a war when there were no people to liberate. That would have been wise.
Military dictatorship, that's unlikely.
They're a bit thick, yes. And we also thought we'd make the bastards drive on the right, we'll make them speak Spanish, they can have our devaluing peso, and they can be happy about it. Anyway.
Well, they expelled them from South Georgia, Bob, and there weren't any people there, except the Argentinians.
The scrap metal dealers, yes. Yes, that was.
I seem to remember it being very popular at my school when people were rushing to sign up.
Yeah?
Yes. And I remember the jingoism of the Sun at the time.
Oh, well, the Sun, that's not the nation, is it?
But I don't particularly remember any sort of forbearance. I don't remember any.
Mm-hmm. Well, nations always think they're going to win and win cheaply and quickly. Even Germans who think about honour think they're going to do it quickly.
Oh yes, they thought it would be quick, very quick.
Fighting might be over before they get to the front.
But there was in Birmingham in Chamberlain Square some demonstrations in favour of the war, and the SPGBers were heckled and in their opposition to the war. In Chamberlain Square, but you know they were public speaking against him, so they asked for it, I suppose. They were heckled quite a bit.
Wasn't there the hypocrisy they were trying to get rid of the Falklands? They were trying to deny the Falklands their right to return to Britain, deny their British passport, whatever.
That was certainly true.
They've been doing all this sort of stuff, and then suddenly they're all kind of
thinking. Oh, it was foolish, yes. They got rid of the Endeavour, about to get rid of the Endeavour, they wouldn't allow them to be British citizens. Oh, yes, it was giving a sign to the Argentinians to say, we're very disinterested in this. But so much of a sign was it, they should have got the wink and said, wait 10 years, we wouldn't have any aircraft carriers left, and they sold them off to the Indians, is it? And they might be able to mount an operation. But they also thought they wouldn't have any kind of operation, because, come on, it's a long way, and
Norman Angel, for all his popularity at the time, is not very well known today. Is he also not very well known, or not at all influential amongst intellectuals such as people discussing international relations, teaching international relations?
It's fairly well known in peace studies. When I went to the University of Bradford to study the problem of peace, which I went to, oddly enough, because I was obsessed with the liberal solution to the problem of war, I went to test it out, so I try and get them to test it out. He was well known there, so they know him as an authority in peace studies. In fact, they received the Nobel Prize for Peace and so on, and the fact that they still read his books there. But they don't have much criticism of him. I was trying to get them to be critical of him, but I couldn't get them to be all that critical of him. I didn't get what I went for, actually. What I got, oddly enough, is the University of Bradford peace studies. I got a whole bunch of things which nothing whatsoever to do with war, like, for example, anti-racism, feminism, and so on, which they felt was absolutely related to war, properly understood. But I think there's no proper understanding in which you can relate those to the problem of war. They're different concepts.
There's another liberal way of looking at war is to treat it as a species of crime.
because after all, at the end of the day, it is the same thing. It's a large bunch of people getting together and committing the most heinous crimes that we see. And so one might say, well, what's the liberal solution to crime? One solution is, well, the richer a society is and the richer people are, the less inclined they are to commit crimes to get what they want, because it's not worth it. There are much easier ways to get your wealth, and it's probably no surprise that if you go back 200 or 300 years, when society was dirt poor, there was a lot more crime, because it probably did make sense rationally to commit crimes then to get what you wanted. It makes much less sense now. But it might be said that the two are not mutually exclusive, that one route towards less war is more wealth, and of course one route towards more wealth is also free trade, less state.
Well, I think the problem with that, David, is that it's false. You know, it strikes me that the years from 1850 to 1950 were the years when Britain was less well off than it is today, and the years where Britain were particularly peaceful. And in those years, of course, Sir Robert Peel introduced the police force, and it was until recently Britain had the only unarmed police force, and even now there's still the police force is largely unarmed, owing to achieving that that peaceful century between 1850 and 1950. There is an anthropologist, I think I sent this to Pat, there's an anthropologist called Jeffrey Gorer, who was a friend of George Orwell, who talks about people coming out of a football match in the 1950s as though they're coming out of church. Now, of course, that for some reason or other started changing in the 1970s when you started getting them coming out of the football matches. A bit like they've got girls coming out attending the Beagles concerts or something. In other words, football started getting mass hysteria around about the 1970s. Heaven knows why. But what we do know is that the crime rate started going up from about 1970 onwards. For example, throughout the 1950s, virtually no stores need to have these metal shutters that they need always universally need to have now. And if they don't have them, one or two stores in Stevenage hasn't got them, and sadly, they've got their windows kicked in overnight very often.
But if you go back, but if you go back 200 years, I mean, crime rates now 1/10 or 1/50 of what they were 200 years ago.
I doubt it. Myself, it's known that it's widely known that the 18th century was a lot of crime, but I tend to doubt that there was more crime in the 18th century than what there is in the 21st century so far on the streets. And of course, people are better off now. And again, I don't think that poverty is going to make people more warlike. I think there is a big division between the problem of crime and the problem of war. I think the problem of crime is largely psychological, whereas I think the problem of war, as I said in my talk, is completely and utterly institutional. I think most people who were called up to fight the war were not criminals and would not have been would not have shot the Germans if they hadn't done it for the sake of their country. The average soldier is not a criminal. And the crime, although it's been rising since about 1970, is still a minority affair. Most men are not criminals. They might commit the odd crime in their life, once in their lifetime, but they're not habitual criminals. The habitual criminals remain a minority of the population. Whereas, when you get the call up, the average man goes to fight, and he goes to fight someone who he has no other quarrel with except the institutional. Falling out of his country with their country and shoots a man who he doesn't even know. Well, it's true that people attack people and mug them when they don't even know them as well, but the point is that they do have the mugger is greedy, whereas the soldier isn't greedy, he's altruistic.
Could you say something about the Cobdenite and the Angel view on imperialism and war?
Oh, they had Cobden and Angel had an identical view on imperialism, which again is a popular idea today. I'm surprised at how popular it is, that Britain must have gained a great deal from its empire, just like people think that there must be some reason why we invaded Iraq. It must be oil or something else. Somewhere we're going to gain, and oil fits the bill. Or if it's not oil, they're gained somewhere else. It's done for gain. Of course, this is. Both Cobden and Angel said it's not done for gain, and they said that the British Empire, again following Smith, Smith's most of the Wealth of Nations is on colonies. The chapter on chapter is colonies continued, colonies continued, is the biggest thing in the Wealth of Nations. And of course Smith points out that that colonies are a pain in the neck as regards Britain, although he himself and this is a big irony in the Wealth of Nations, in the final he delayed the publication of the Wealth of Nations, was finally published in 1776, because he wondered what was going to happen in America. And he said, oh, he says, I don't, Smith said, notwithstanding all these talking about his victim of his himself, he says, I don't want to lose the American colonies. He says, what we can do is we can move the seat of the capital from London to Philadelphia and protect the British Empire. So he was a victim of himself, but nevertheless, you know, it takes one to know one. He knew the psychology of the imperialist. And Cobden, of course, following this, using this as a Bible, used to say at the meetings, up and down the country, India is a millstone round England's neck. You know, the colonies are a pain in the neck. And oddly enough, the person who repeated this, and if you look at some books on flotations, you'll find that it's under his name, is Disraeli. Heaven knows why Disraeli repeated this. He made Victoria the Empress of India. Yet Disraeli himself said, echoing Cobden, in fact he'd heard Cobden, he was impressed by Cobden in the house, just as Peel was, the person who he attacked for becoming a Cobdenite, Disraeli says, India is a millstone around England's neck. So you agree with that point of view, that it didn't pay off. You know, you look at one or two few diamonds in the crown of England, they didn't pay for the railways in India. You know, in other words, the farm war went from Sheffield to the public urinals in India. When you're urinating, you look at it, made in Sheffield. And so, up and down India, the sort of investment from England to India wasn't like the few jewels in the crown and one or two other things that personal fortune of Clive of India and one or two other things that were taken from India. More was put back into India. It's the same with again the life of Brian, which is a killer in all this. Not only in the fact that these little groups are against each other, but also what have the Romans done for us? Well, they've done and then it goes on and on and on. It's not just one thing, but it goes on almost a page of things they did. Empire has always been the mother country, masochistically being a mother and giving the child more than what the child perhaps needs.
I'd just like to point out about the Indian railways that though the money may have been British which was put into it, all the investors were guaranteed 5% a year regardless of whether the railways made a profit, which they never did, never have done.
Yes.
And so the Indian taxpayer was taxed very heavily to pay this 5% to British investors. So you could hardly say that the British invested in India. It was the Indian money which actually paid for it.
So, I mean, English materials went into India.
Well, that was paid for.
Yeah, paid for, yes. Oh, yeah, paid for.
They never had to pay for it.
Yeah.
So it's absurd to say that that was an investment in India. Because the only money which came out was not from profits which were never made. There were no profits ever made on railways in India. And the 5% guarantee by the Indian government, which is the British government, of course, was paid for through taxation of the Indian government.
Yeah, I'm not saying that it was an ideal position. I'm not an imperialist. I'm not advocating empire. It's all I'm saying is that England put in more, just talking material terms, England in material terms put more into India than it took out. Money wise, it might be different.
The Indian army was
financed by the Indians, and it was used extensively for empire purposes. And things like the Golden Jubilee was financed mainly out of the Indian office. Many, many things were paid for by India. It was extraordinary, the drain on the Indian purse. All of which pushed up taxation in India on people who weren't earning much anyway, which of course is the main reason for the collapse of British power in India in the end. Anyway, there you go.
Yeah, I think we can safely say that, like war, it pays some people, and it pays the people. It pays the people who it does pay to convince other people. It pays everyone gains from it. So we need a war to avoid something bad. We need an empire to gain something good. Now, some people like the friends of neocons in America might be gaining from war expenditure. It might be that some people might gain from empire building. But the idea was that we all either got something good or avoided something bad. And we can agree that although it pays some, it doesn't pay everybody in both cases.
I just think that England put a hell of a lot into India. I mean, it's paid for, all right. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's economic and so on. I'm just saying that the traffic was more from.
It's been like somebody coming to your house and saying, "Look, I'll build you a bathroom." Okay, isn't that wonderful? Now you've got to pay me.
No, I'm not saying
you. Who paid for the bathroom? Yeah. The guy built the bathroom,
oh.
Or you who paid for it? Come on. You can't say that the builder is actually putting something into a house because you're getting more out of it than you do. It's the case of the poor Indian.
Well, I think that's false. I think the builder is putting more into it.
He's not investing, is he?
Well,
not an investment, no.
Is there any mileage in the assertion that after the war the sort of an economic boom and therefore it was?
I don't think so. No, I think it is true that war obfuscates a wage drop. You know, in other words, people after the Second World War took they're fooled by these things, but there always was, from an economic point of view, a shortage of labour throughout the 1930s. But they weren't in a mind to take low wages, whereas the war and the inflation in the war and so on encouraged people to take a tremendous amount of lower wages. They accepted an age of austerity after the war, and this brought about full employment. So I think that the war helped to shake people up into taking a wage cut which got them into work. But they could have done that without the war, in which case they'd have been a lot better off. I mean, I agree with Pat on the idea that what the state does isn't necessarily economic. I'm not saying that. I do think that the person who pays gets more than what he pays for on the market or even in nationalised industries.
I want to pick up on something you said earlier on about causes of war, biological, sociological, or psychological. What about the role of testosterone? Animals fight over territory all the time. We are an animal. Do you think there'd be war if we were a female-only species and there were no males, only females, but a state? Do you think there'd be war then?
Oh, I don't know. What we do know, when we had female rulers,
think about particularly territorial wars over territory.
Yeah, I don't know. But what I do know is when we had female rulers, like for example, when you had lady who was on the Russian throne, Catherine the Great. In the history of Russia and Germany, they've been splitting up Poland, haven't they? And they did a split of Poland in that, and half went to Germany and half went to Russia. And Frederick the Great said, Catherine tried as she accepted the deal, but she still took her half. So. But I don't really know. I think about testosterone in general. I think it is a factor that makes for crime rather than for war. You know, it's true that the soldiers have generally been male, and they have more testosterone than female. But it isn't. I don't think that war is testosterone driven so much as crime is testosterone driven. So I think testosterone makes for crime, problems of crime, rather than problems of war. As I say, the war constricts people who are normally law-abiding into fighting people who they wouldn't otherwise fight. But if we all had female levels of testosterone, I don't know. I think it is possible to have the state without having war. You know, I think Cobden was right in that respect. But I do think it's safer if we don't have the state at all.
Switzerland seems to manage.
Switzerland, yes. Managed quite well.
Quite a large defence budget, though.
Mm.
And that every man has to.
Yeah, everyone's
armed.
That level of gun crime as well.
Are they?
Apparently. The myth that Switzerland doesn't have low levels of gun crime.
Well, not available.
There are guns everywhere. Most people, lots of people, are shot by the people nicking the guns out of their hands and using them on the street.
Oh, Steve.
I think, David, that. Angel did think that the Smith of War was institutional. There's a chapter in the Great Revolution where he, which is why do we fight and must we fight? And the whole, his whole pack, this whole obsession he had with the League of Nations and the United Nations, it is his institutional solution. I think it's the wrong one, you know, but I don't think he talks about, well, the man might be aggressive or they might not be aggressive, but that's besides the point. You know, they're aggressive in society anyway, and we have the court and the police force to deal with things like that. And he wanted some equivalent in international relations, something that would be accepted outside the state in the way that we accept the police and the courts within the state. And that was his problem, really. He went for the League of Nations, particularly. But that, in effect, meant that he wanted the policing done by Britain, backed up by France. And even if Britain had been much more powerful in the 1920s and 30s, it would have been a problem. But if you think about it, Britain was about 45 million population. Arrayed against it was Germany, Russia, eventually Italy and Japan, and it simply wasn't on. And his policy, which turned out to be in effect the equivalent of Churchill's in 1930, was made war pretty well inevitable.
Yes, I think you're right, Steve. I think I probably have made a mistake when I've stressed that he overlooked the institutions as well. But what I meant is that it's just, you know, I think that he didn't particularly see the state as causing war so much. He saw it more as international anarchy between the states. You know, perhaps I'm a bit wrong in saying that he completely overlooked the institutional thing. However, I will say in his favour, against what you said in your recent piece on him, that first of all, he did think that America would come in, and secondly, he made a very big fuss, not just about the 50 million in Britain, which were outweighed by 70 million in Russia, in Germany, but also he included very much so the British Empire, which of course had far more than 50 million. And he did see, but whilst he was against the empire, he thought there was a lot of myth of empire that Britain gained unnecessarily from it economically, but when it comes to an institution of deterring places like Germany, he thought that, and I think in this he's right, because, you know, and here I think Angel makes a mistake about Hitler. In the 1947 book, The Steep Places, Angel says that by the way, Angel was a big influence on Wilson and the 14 points, and he had a lot of conversations. He had one conversation with Wilson, but he had a lot of conversations with Colonel House, who was in contact with Wilson. He was kind of like Wilson's Henry Kissinger of the day, of like Nixon, he was in touch with Colonel House. He was more or less against what House was doing, but with MacDonald and with Northcliffe, he kept in touch with them and tried to influence them. He did try to get America into the League of Nations, but of course, as you know, Wilson lost out on that, and America went in for isolationism. But he also thought that the British Empire would be a big deterrent, and the populations there. And he thought that he praises the British Empire no end in his 1947 book, pointing out that America wouldn't have been much use coming in to help Britain if Britain hadn't got the British Empire to supply bases around the world in order for the Anglo-American counter-reaction to Hitler and so on. And he reckons that without the British Empire, notwithstanding all its faults, which he was obviously, as we covered, he was against the British Empire to begin with, but without the British Empire, he thinks that the war would have been lost.
I mean, the obvious points are that Britain didn't stop the Japanese in Manchuria.
Yeah.
Didn't stop the Italians in Abyssinia. Didn't stop the Germans in Alaska.
Yes, I think
and
you're right on all
of
that.
Finally, tried to stop them in Poland. They discovered they hadn't any troops in Poland.
Yes, I think that's right. But as Pat was pointing out to me the other day, the Poland thing, whilst it was futile, in so far as they couldn't really do much about it, it did attempt to signify to Hitler that they meant business. Of course, as
it just didn't work out because Hitler by that stage didn't give it any credibility and thought that they could that they were just bluffing over Poland. But it did signify that they would fight, even though and that might have deterred. Pat Mark,
I think the other reason for the Poland business was, of course, the British were all in favour of peace up to 1939.
Yeah.
And they needed to be turned around and made enthusiastic about war in Poland, I believe, was another reason. Was the reason for generating war enthusiasm, which it did, of course.
It was another poor little Belgium, wasn't it?
Yeah. Right.
It was another example of poor little Belgium. As yeah. Similar kind of thing, small nation being bullied by a big one. Could you say more about the distinction between which Angel did at one stage seem to him take in from Cobden and others, that once the nation is doing very little and all nations are doing the same, so very little intervention, security of property, freedom of contract, freedom of movement, capital and labour, once all nations are doing that, apart from you might like the flag or the folk songs or whatever, so you might like to live somewhere, but it makes no practical difference, apart from those things that you like, maybe where you're brought up, your language, the rest of it. But the point is you don't have to go to war. There's no good in war. So you don't need a world policeman, because no one sees the sense in it. It's like in a society, a friendly society, we don't have a hammer and tongs with each other, because what's the point? Pass the lemonade and do this, do that. But there's no need for war. We don't need it for Lebensraum, we don't need it for the raw material, we don't need it for the energy security, which is a modern version of the same kind of thing. But Angel seemed to move from the first position to the idea of a world policeman, anti-terrorist.
Yes, he slowly moved from that. But for most of the time, most of his points in favour of the British Empire is that it didn't really make, again, this might be the sort of thing which is overlooking the honour point of it, but it didn't make much difference from the average person in India or something, as long as they're providing good government, if they were providing good government, insofar as you can do that. It didn't make much difference whether India was part of the British Empire or not. Bauer points out sometimes that up until about 1946, whilst it wasn't faultless, some of the African states were governed not too badly. But after 1946, Bauer reckons they went down the swan, too much aid and so on, and was governed less well. Angel with the tribute. I was surprised when I found in reading Mises in Socialism that he actually does say that the British Empire is open to a free trade zone largely, and open to German investment or French investment. And we do know, don't we, that most of us know anyway, that there's far more British investment in Argentina than there was in many of the colonies. A lot of British investment in South America.
Apparently American audiences wouldn't believe Angel when he said anyone can sell in India.
That's right.
They wouldn't believe, no, you have the empire, so it's you alone can sell in India. Said, no. Wouldn't believe it.
Can I make a point about America?
Yes, I do.
America came quite late into the Second World War.
Yes.
But I don't know if you're aware that they gave food aid from the start of the First and Second World War to countries like India and Burma and Sri Lanka and places like that, and also Britain. Food came here right throughout the Second World War. Things like wheat and corn and things from the States.
Yes, I had read that there were some food aid from America to places like Burma and India. I had read that.
There is a more cynical interpretation. In the 30s, America had a farm price support system, and the farmers were turning out the food, but
yes.
At that price they couldn't sell it because that would depress the price. So the silos and granaries were building up, and eventually they sold it to Stalin. Who had very little grain because they had forced collectivization and the farmers were all dead. Okay. Many of them were dead.
Even at that time, they had genetically modified meat.
Not the who's the silly Russian?
Isenko.
He was trying to modify it, by the old fashioned way.
He's a Lamarckian. He's as tough as I was when I was 17.
He tried to bully it into being a different kind of rice or potato.
Yeah.
It never worked.
He had Lamarckian principles.
I'd like to say something about the Greens and Hitler. Hitler ties into two things here. He's a bit like the Greens. He thought you couldn't just have free trade. When push comes to shove, it's going to run out, or someone's got all the oil, or you haven't got enough water, or something. It's going to require war. We can't. There are too many of us. We're breeding like, you know, whatever. So some people have got to be wasted for a start. Because they're no good to us genetically. But also, there's probably just too many people anyway, in the Asian hordes and what have you. So that's a bit green. That's one aspect about Hitler. The other one is the more glory bit that you touched on with the Germans, an honour. And that still applies now.
Yes.
You always get the thing with Hitler and some people that even if you could sit him down in a quiet moment and show him about free trade, you go, that's no way for a man to live.
Yes.
That's no kind of life. You putter about, you know, you have a little pocketbook and you build it back account, you save a bit. That's not, but we're the warriors. We're in the big battle. So they wouldn't like that kind of thing. And now, in a different kind of version, we have the Americans saying, you must give something back to society. You know, you can, the highest way you can serve your country is to go abroad and kill some poor ad sack. There is no better thing you can do with your life than that. Now, that, again, is honour, not obvious. They think there's something in it as well, perhaps security, oil security. Energy security, maybe, but there's a lot of honour to do with it, sadly.
Yes. This end of history and the last man played up on it a great deal. So people just don't understand how, these people who oppose politics, they don't understand how politics carries the honour.
Mm-hmm.
And what they want is the world where all material interests are faced. You know, no one can stand that. We need some politics into the game. For the army. But of course, the irony when Bob was saying that about Hitler, Mussolini, of course, was people were courting him and trying to patch between him and Hitler. And of course, they saw him as a man of peace, and Mussolini hated that. And he said, what he hated is that Hitler had beat him to this war game. He wanted to be the one who started the wars. And he was sorry that he wasn't the one who started the wars rather than Hitler. You know, and yet they called him a man of peace. That was the last thing he wanted
to be. He declared war against France in about the last week, I believe, and got something into the Riviera. I'm not sure. Any more questions? No, I think we can declare the meeting over and thank our speaker, David McDonough.
Thank you. I don't know, I haven't got one yet. I'm looking around for one. Is there anyone willing to give us a talk? Are you willing to give us a talk, Jan?
On what subject?
Well, what subject do you want to speak on? What about you, Steve? Could you give us a talk on something next time?
You've just given the talk out here.
Oh.